you know, the 10-point plan in many ways is like a down payment. It's kind of a first kind of serious effort. It's the 10% that you put down and you still need to come up with the remaining 90% or quite large sums to actually see this come to fruition. So it's, you know, the 10-point plan is really just the first step.
That was right from the middle of this week's episode. Stay tuned to know more about UK's proposed strategies to get to a net zero economy. Hello and a warm welcome to yet another episode on the Mission Shunya podcast. For all the new listeners, just a quick introduction. The Mission Shunya podcast, by the way, Shunya means zero, covers all global stories around this transition to a zero carbon economy. We are nearing 50 episodes, so feel free to check the archive or the playlist to listen to any of the previous episodes. If you liked it, pass it along to a friend or a colleague. We have one new episode every 2 weeks. This week, our guest Dr. David Reiner is a political scientist, a senior lecturer at the University of Cambridge at the Judge Business School, an expert when it comes to technology and energy policy. Well, and I had the privilege to be guided by him while I was there pursuing my master's. And on this episode, we talk all about the UK's energy policy, its priorities as it transitions to a net zero economy, the new 10-point action plan, the plans around demobility, the strategies in carbon capture and storage, the upcoming COP26, and a lot more. With that brief, let's jump into the feature segment. Hello, Dr. Reiner. Welcome to the Mission Shunya podcast. Glad to have you on the show.
Pleasure to be here, Girish. Good to finally catch up with you.
Yes, I have to say that it's been an absolute pleasure to having known you for a few years. And in fact, I've been glad that you were my supervisor when I did my master's thesis. So, Dr. Reiner, I asked guests this general question about what got interested in the work, what got them interested in their work. So let's have a brief background on you are an expert in technology policy. You have worked with various government and non-government for a long time, multiple research publications. And so where did it all begin for you? How did you get interested in the policy aspect?
Yeah, that's a great question. My first degree was in physics. And I actually started a PhD in plasma physics. My PhD was in, well, I was getting it in Princeton.
Okay.
I was working at a large U.S. national lab at the time. And the lab was actually going through all sorts of budget cuts, which had nothing to do with the science they were doing there, but everything to do with, or one of the aspects was the fact that the House of Representatives Science Committee chairman had been from New Jersey, which is where Princeton is based, and he retired, and then it was taken up by somebody from Texas who didn't see why you should give as much money to a lab based in Princeton. And I mean, I always have had an interest in kind of, if you want more, some of the social science, social side of things. But I think that kind of helped catalyzed my leap out of the hard sciences, and you know that kind of led me to do more policy based work.
And then you went to MIT.
That's right. So my PhD. So I worked in Washington D.C. for a couple of years as an environmental consultant, and then did my PhD in political science at MIT.
How did the move to Cambridge happen? What got you to Cambridge?
Again, like many people, you know, life is full of happenstance. I was finishing up my PhD, and the Chancellor of the Exchequer at that time was Gordon Brown, and he had given $100 million, £60 million for MIT to work with Cambridge. And as part of that, they established some research collaborations, one of which is turned into our energy policy research group.
Okay.
And another, in terms of aspect of this, was our half dozen or so new master's programs, MPhil programs here at Cambridge, one of which was Engineering for Sustainable Development, which is where you came to me from, and the other was Master's in Technology Policy. So I was one of the two first faculty to start with this new master's program here at Cambridge. So that kind of came more or less right after, after I did a year of postdoc at MIT, and then I started up here.
That's a wonderful journey and a wonderful move to Cambridge. Now, once you were in Cambridge and in UK, I think UK was undergoing a transition, or globally, countries were moving out from the economic crisis of 2008-9. And at that time, I think one of the reports that came out was the Stern Review, and that had a significant impact on how policies were framed in the UK, in the energy sector particularly. How did that happen, and what was the impact of the Stern Review on the policies that UK framed after that?
Well, I mean, I would take a step back even before that. I mean, you know, I arrived here in, I think, 2003, and almost every year in that period, we seem to be having a different kind of major energy white paper or kind of rethinking long-held views on energy policy, on climate policy. So I think that period kind of in the early 2000s was quite an active period in kind of rethinking this. And one of the things, as you say, one of the more sort of arguably globally important aspects of that was commissioning Lord Stern and Nick Stern at LSE to write this Stern Review on the economics of climate change. And I think that, you know, I think that had, you know, in many ways was in some ways a symptom as much as a cause of what happened here. It kind of reflected a significant amount of kind of built up interest in these issues by the UK government. And so I do think that has been one of the kind of defining times in terms of having UK not just energy policy, but kind of moving climate as an issue to kind of a fairly high level of attention in terms of the UK government policy. So, you know, it was also at that time that in the kind of early 2000s that the UK through its embassies actually had climate attachés or energy and climate attachés in many of their embassies. You know, I know even in their consulates. So in China, for example, they had not just in the embassy in Beijing, but in a half dozen consulates, they had that climate attaché. So it, you know, became quite an important aspect of not just domestic but foreign policy. And I think the Stern Review, because of its kind of global reach, I think also had that same, you know, played a role in that type of wider reach.
True, as you rightly said, the Stern Review had a wider reach, and the subsequent actions actually kind of helped UK get to at least make solid progress, running up to say even the Paris Agreement in 2015, and subsequently after that, UK has made like significant announcements, one of which is the target to go to net zero by 2050, which we will talk about in detail. And how confident were you when the first announcement was made of UK getting to net zero by 2050?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think it is important to say that the UK has tried to be a bit of a pioneer in that regard. I mean, the latest way of talking about it is in terms of net zero, but we had we just celebrated, I guess, the 10th anniversary of the Climate Change Act, which set into law the what was then seen as very ambitious 60% target by 2050, and then an 80% target. And then just last year, we've established a net zero, so this 100% target. I think my view is still probably the same, which is I don't think we're necessarily yet on track for even 60%. You know, it's a really quite dramatic transformation of the economy that we're asking for. We have a very wide range of activities, wide range of things that need to be addressed when you're talking about decarbonizing the entire economy. And so, you know, I think it's you know, to the credit in many ways of the UK government for taking this on, and I think that's a very positive thing. But you know, my initial reaction is, gosh, this is really difficult.
You do mention about activities, the list of activities that a country has to take up in order to reach at least even a certain small percentage of that target. But are you impressed with the 10-point action plan that the government has put up? Some claim that it has come a little late, but in the overall structure, do you think the government has got the right sections, right list of activities? Has it got the priorities right?
Well, it depends how you define that, but you know, in many ways, the remit is right. So, you know, it covers everything from, you know, buildings. You know, we have famously the kind of the worst building stock in Europe in terms of anybody who's lived here would know. You know, quite a poor, you know, a lot of, I mean, again, it age and, you know, old building stock. You know, very unsuccessful efforts to renovate and so on. So everything from buildings to things like aviation, which would be really difficult, for example. So yeah, I mean, I think the broad brush of it is right. The real question is, you know, scale. So we have a Green Homes grant of, I think it's £1 billion this year. And so the announcement in the 10-point plan is they're going to extend the Green Homes grant by another year. And that gives another £1 billion. And that's fine. But, you know, it's probably, you know, an order of magnitude lower than what it needs to be if we are serious about, you know, kind of the scale of the challenge, and that's what it, you know, comes back to. I think I think the UK has been quite good at trying to focus on climate more than maybe other ancillary issues. But I think the scale of the, you know, spending that would be needed, the scale of the, you know, potential, you know, restrictions that might be put on people's lives or businesses or the types of regulations that might need to come into being, I think will be, you know, really quite challenging.
That is exactly right. But I see one particular change in this approach is that government has listed down a set of activities that will take in the next couple of years on each particular action point. Like it said, it'll come up with the energy plan and the energy white paper is out. So hopefully all the proposals, all the plans that it has said it'll do probably comes up with some solid recommendations. Do you think that's a positive sign?
Well, again, it is a, you know, the energy white paper is much longer than the 10-point plan.
Exactly.
But mostly it still is a sort of commitment to develop things. You know, so it's, you know, by 2022, we will develop business models to get, you know, low carbon hydrogen or CCUS clusters or, you know, these sorts of measures off the ground. It's not in there yet. It's still sort of a commitment to do something in the future. So I think that is still a big challenge.
But the overall narrative seems to be like, pretty ambitious. Like, for example, the electric vehicle ecosystem, right, from having batteries in the West Midlands to having factories and everything rolling out electric mobility in UK, I think is a pretty good picture, if I were to put it that way.
On the electric vehicles, that is probably the most concrete announcement, which is this kind of 2030 announcement that they won't be selling, they'll still be selling potentially very efficient hybrids or something, but they won't be selling any fossil vehicles after 2030. So that, I mean, that is a concrete announcement, and that's you know, quite substantial and you know, a bit ahead of other countries.
Yeah, I think we should also point out that government has come up, scaled down as well. Last year it had a different target about 2035, 2040. Now it said like 2030 is the year that we are going to stop this. So I think they have been pretty aggressive in that front.
Yeah, no, so, you know, I think that's a very positive development, very concrete development, and something that will be quite challenging, because that means you need to get all the, you know, associated infrastructure in place by then. You can't tell people that they need to buy electric vehicles when there are no charging points. I mean, I have a friend and neighbor who ended up buying an electric vehicle, who was, you know, personally negotiating with the Cambridge council as to whether they would be able to set up a charging point near his home. You know, it shouldn't be up to the individuals to be doing
exactly
that. We for this to work, we need to be able to have a kind of wide scale rollout so that anybody that needs it, regardless of whether they have off street parking or on street parking, regardless of whether they're, you know, tower block in London or whatever, that they would have access to this. So that is a big challenge to roll out over the next decade.
How do you think the investment numbers that the government says it'll commit into these projects, do you think is a little justified? I guess it might be a little early in few categories, but overall, what's your opinion on the investment forecast that the government has published?
It's still, if you want, TBD, right? To be determined. I think there's, as I said, a lack of clarity as to what actually will materialize. There are commitments to these, as I said, you know, business models, financing models, and so on. But there aren't hard and fast commitments in detailed terms. On the positive side, I mean, the Treasury, you know, the UK's finance ministry is very is paying attention to this in the last year or two in a way that probably hadn't been the case until then. So I think there is a much greater awareness in the center of what the, you know, thinking more carefully about the implications and maybe a bit more commitment to this. But that doesn't mean that there are, you know, bankable decisions that a chemicals company in Scotland or a steel mill in South Wales can do anything with. It's all still up in the air.
True. In that sense, do you think that the government's plan and this 10-point action plan has come up as a build-up to the COP26 that's happening in UK in 2021? Do you think, is it all building up in a way that UK is trying to position itself as a leader in getting to net zero and driving other countries forward?
I think that does play a big part of it. I mean, it's a bit of an accident that it's November 2021 instead of November 2020, right? Because it was meant to be last month.
Exactly.
Nevertheless, I mean, I think it is seen as a great opportunity for the UK to be on the international stage on an issue where it actually has, you know, in many ways been a genuine leader for the last number of years. It's also not, again, accidental that, you know, at a time of Brexit, which we don't like to talk here in Cambridge, but, you know, at a time of Brexit, that it is an opportunity for the UK to show some sort of international diplomacy and international leadership on this issue. And, you know, it doesn't hurt, for example, that there's a new, you know, incoming Biden administration in the US. And so this is, again, one of the areas where the UK has taken, you know, quite an active role, you know, in its time in the EU. It was actually a big advocate for putting climate change front and center. So in the early 2010s, when Ed Davey was Secretary of State, he kind of led the push in the EU to make the 2030 target, which the EU is now ratcheting up. But, you know, he kind of led the charge to put climate and not, say, renewables targets as the core of the European effort. I think, you know, I think the timing in many ways is quite fortuitous for the UK.
So that's an interesting word that you bring out, Dr. Reiner, because early on in a decade ago, the narrative was predominantly around getting to a certain percentage of renewable energy. But do you think that all around the world, the narrative has now shifted to climate tech, climate action in a big way? People, governments, companies, everyone is talking about climate action rather than just being focused on energy or energy efficiency.
I mean, to some extent. I mean, I think you have, in many ways, renewables is the most visible or in many people's minds understandable kind of green effort. You know, yes, I mean, a couple of years ago, we had RE100, which is, you know, many companies switching over to 100% renewables. And now you have many companies increasingly moving to net zero commitments in terms of countries. I think, EU being a case in point, you have increasingly that focus on the broader climate agenda. And, you know, I think that's good because it kind of broadens the discussion so that we also, you know, we can't just focus on building up renewables while having, deforestation or, kind of large amounts of methane and so on going into the atmosphere. So I think there is kind of a positive move, I think, in that sense. But it does also complicate things, which is the other side of that story, which is that it is, you know, easier to just say we're going to build an extra 10, 20 gigawatts of solar or wind, and it's much harder to do all this other bits because, you know, I mentioned the earlier targets of 60% or 80%. When we had an 80% target, you know, everybody could believe that they were in the 20% or a large number of individuals and companies and so on believe, oh, no. Well, our part is not, you know, the 80%. So I do think that net zero means that everybody, every sector, even these kind of hard to reach sectors have to be decarbonized. And that is a big challenge.
That perfectly leads me to my next question and a question that you probably be very interested because you talk about the harder problems. And one particular problem or technology that you've been an active advocate or you're trying to push policies around it is carbon capture and storage. What's your take on that? And do you think at least now that government in the 10-point plan or even subsequently in the next plan that it says will lay out by building 4 sites in UK by the next decade, do you think there is some move at least now?
That's a good question. I mean, one thing to say is I've been following this for many years. I'm people that know me well enough probably wouldn't say I'm a big advocate.
Follower. Yeah, sorry to I rephrase that.
No, but I mean, you know, in many ways, to me, it's fairly closely tied to some of these deeper commitments on climate and net zero and so on. And so if we are, you know, I think it's quite difficult to get to net zero or to do really ambitious things without carbon capture and storage. It's also one of the few aspects of these kind of portfolio that really only has a climate-based justification. So there are lots of reasons why you might, well, people had been supporting, say, nuclear power or even renewables before climate was there as a rationale for advancing it, on grounds of energy independence and security concerns, you know, not being reliant on foreign sources of energy and so on. You know, carbon capture and storage, mostly what it does is it adds cost. Right, and if it's adding cost, you are doing that, you know, the only grounds you're doing it are on climate grounds, essentially. So I think that is one of the big questions. How serious should this be? You know, so the government has now increased its, again, if we're talking narrowly in the UK, has increased its commitment up to back up to £1 billion. It was £1 billion more than a decade ago when they had a £1 billion competition that was only focused on coal because that was meant to be with a bit of, I don't know, arrogance maybe, but essentially a way of showing the Chinese how to do things, I think was ultimately underpinning logic in the kind of late 2000s. That competition failed.
True.
Then there was a second competition, again for £1 billion, that was launched in 2011 by the coalition government between the Conservatives and Liberal Democrats. And that failed when the majority Conservative government came in and George Osborne, in his first budget, as kind of for a majority Conservative government, essentially killed the £1 billion that was on the table. So here we are back again at £1 billion. So that in itself is not to me much very convincing. I think the wider political economy is probably more favorable, though. I think one of the things that they've done has been to move away from a strict focus on power to a wider view that, again, back to the idea that we need to target not just certain sectors, but all of, you know, the entire economy. And one of the harder bits to deal with is industry, energy intensive industry in particular. So moving away from power towards these industrial clusters. We had sort of Claire Perry, who was the energy minister at the time, commissioned a cost challenge task force. I was on that. A number of others were on that, colleagues, and you know, and I think a very positive takeaway from that, which was in 2018, was to shift the focus to these industrial clusters. And so they've created an industrial decarbonization challenge that has recently been in the process of awarding some kind of initial funding for these clusters. And so that's, I think, the narrative, I think, there works a fair bit better because it's not just about something that's out of sight, but actually matters to local communities, whether you're in South Wales or in Teesside in the northeast, or Humberside, you know, or in kind of the Liverpool Manchester area in the northwest of England. So I think that you know, I think that's quite promising. It's quite I wouldn't underestimate the challenges. I mean, the decarbonizing industry is inevitably going to be harder because it's it really is involves sectors that are exposed to trade. So they have this credible threat that if you hike up costs, if you raise costs, then we'll go somewhere else to make our chemicals or cement or steel. And so I think that puts a onus on government to come up with ways to make this more appealing to the industry in a way that, you know, power sector largely is stuck here, whereas these industries are much more able to leave. So I think that is a big challenge. But you know, but on the positive side of this, in terms of support for CCS, and I think also for hydrogen, for that matter, which is the kind of related aspect of this, I think that makes the story much more compelling. And then just one final point in terms of the political economy, it's not an accident that many of these clusters are in areas that are kind of in the UK we'd call marginal constituencies, you know, these so-called red wall seats. You know, these are seats that, you know, might alternate between, which had been in many cases Labour seats, or had been alternating between being Labour and Conservative seats. So if you're seen as a delivering effective action, not just on climate, but in terms of regional development, and it also has, you know, kind of, you know, political importance, then that does get the attention of political political leaders who can see not just kind of the green benefits, but also some of the wider societal and even political benefits associated with those type of investments.
It's nice that you put it that way on the wider political economy of the UK aspect as well. And as you rightly said, maybe the maturity of the technology or the political will of the companies and others are also favorable at this point for CCS to at least have a good start, if I were to put it. You have written a lot of articles, and recently I think you did write about the social equity part of CCS as well, that UK as a country is fine, but again, carbon capture and storage, again, it boils down to every country has to do this if the entire climate justice or the climate action has to be successful. What's your view on the equitable distribution of the CCS part?
Equity is always a big challenge here. You know, one of the aspects that we're looking at, for example, is on heat. And so, you know, the largest single source of emissions in the UK is heating our buildings, and that's largely done through natural gas. And, you know, for example, natural gas only has a VAT, a value added tax of 5%. Compared to kind of for all other goods and services, or most other goods and services, which is at 20%. So I think that is a big challenge. The logic, I mean, has always been on the grounds that, and it's also household electricity that is also, you know, taxed at 5%. And you know, I think there are grounds on, equity concerns that people don't want, you know, you don't want to discourage people from running running their boiler on a cold winter night. There's kind of a well-known phenomenon of excess winter deaths in the UK, where because of poorly insulated homes, you have a not insignificant number dying. I mean, I think I looked at one point, and I think the number was, I think, as large as in the UK as it is in Canada, where I'm from, which is outrageous.
True,
but that's because, you know, we insulate our homes in Canada. So, but you know, that touches on this whole question of equity and how you would decarbonize our heating system. And, you know, one way would be to shift to heat pumps, which would be electric. But then, you know, the problem is on the very coldest nights, how do you get the size of the system large enough that you're going to have, you know, the flexibility of the system that would mean on a cold, windless night. So you might have lots and lots of wind, but how do you know, know that you're going to be able to assure the availability of that wind? And so that's why you would need, you know, decarbonized firm power, and that ends up being either nuclear or, you know, CCS or other types of power, like you know, bioenergy with CCS that might help you allow you to have a bit more emissions. But you know, so those are some of the big questions. But they come back to your original point about equity, that making these types of moves, doing these, you know, kind of not just climate policy, but energy policy actions aren't just a matter of, you know, overall cost of so many billions, but could potentially have disproportionate impacts on those who are least able to pay. So that's, you know, that would be something that you need to take cognizance of and be very careful in addressing and designing a kind of a new decarbonized system.
True. That is well said on the point of inequity. Before we move to the final question, one quick question on, since we are talking about equity, do you think the overall plan, the 10-point plan, and the entire decarbonization strategy to going to net zero, are you positive on the impact that it could have on in terms of job creation or bringing back manufacturing to UK? Do you think there is a positive vibe to this. I mean, you don't have to make a political answer, but give a political answer. But do you think this is a positive vibe?
I mean, it's a great question. I think I'm not sure I'm optimistic about bringing a lot of manufacturing jobs back. I mean, I think there is the danger of losing, fewer manufacturing jobs if you want. So I think, the future of UK steel manufacturing is at stake, and chemicals and so on. So we've already lost or shut down a significant fraction of steel mills already. And the question, I think, is what will be left going forward. So I'm not sure if that's a optimistic as much as it is sort of a defensive way of thinking about this. I think that, the 10-point plan in many ways is like a down payment. It's kind of a first kind of serious effort, but it's going to require
the annuities that come.
Yeah. It's going to, and again, probably similar order of magnitude, it's the 10% that you put down and you still need to come up with the remaining 90% or quite large sums to actually see this come to fruition. So it's, the 10-point plan is really just the first step.
That's a good way, a rather positive way to put it. Now, ending on a positive note, we spoke about UK's position or growing prominence in climate action. And one particular thing that's caught the global attention was when DEC, Department of Energy, early on had this calculator developed by Sir David Mackay. Now it's called the Mackay calculator. That modeling approach was adopted by a lot of other countries, including in India. So now with this approach of going to net zero again, with UK becoming the first major country to announce, and a lot of other countries, and even China has announced of going to net zero by a particular year. Do you think this is progressing well in terms of climate action on a large scale country level?
Well, I mean, just as an endorsement of the, I don't know about climate action, but I would strongly endorse the Mackay calculator, which was literally, I think, just a week or two ago relaunched by BEIS, the UK Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy. And there's kind of a higher level of version, and then there's kind of a more kind of detailed version that's called the Mackay calculator that they've launched. And I think that's great. And David was always very much an advocate of, as he would say, numbers needed to add up.
True.
And so that I think, comes down to it, I think, for the UK, but also all these other countries that are, I don't know, joining the bandwagon is the right word, but committing to climate, carbon neutrality, or committing to taking tougher actions. I think that's all good, but ultimately there's still a long way to go. I mean, I think many of these actions don't look and feel all that different yet from what would have been happening anyhow. And the example is always, this year, right? This infamous 2020, we'll have a 8% reduction in emissions. And to get to net zero by, this kind of time frame, we need to be doing 8% a year every year. And we're not going to be doing it through lockdowns. But it does give you a sense of just how hard that sort of 8% number, looks like.
Exactly.
And so we can tinker and we can, make some progress and do lots of good things, but to, genuinely make, serious progress will be enormously difficult. It's enormously difficult for the UK, enormously difficult for a country like China, which will have, lots and lots of brand new, pretty much brand new coal-fired power plants. What do they do with all of those by their kind of 2060 target? India is the other obvious big country that we think about in terms of how it's going to turn the corner at some point. But also, if you think about places like sub-Saharan Africa, there's a very strong case for needing robust economic growth in all of these emerging economies. And that is really challenging to do not just with, you know, more and more renewables and more energy efficiency and so on, all of which are very, you know, laudable, but to really move towards kind of the ambition of net zero is something else entirely. And that will be a big challenge, and it is kind of the challenge of the next 3, 4, 5 decades.
That's well said. I totally agree that we can't have lockdowns to hit the target of 8% year-on-year reduction, but it's at least a small positive note at the end of 2020 that we managed to curb emissions by some means, voluntarily or otherwise. So, Dr. Reiner, it's been an absolute pleasure having known you for the last few years and having followed your work ever since. I mean, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast and pick your brain on this topic, the topic that's always fascinating for you to talk about. So thanks for taking time to join me on the podcast.
No, it's been a pleasure, Girish. Really good to catch up, and hopefully we can catch up at some other point that won't be quite this long.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it useful from the perspective of understanding the process involved for a country to get to a net zero economy. As Dr. Reiner mentioned, the 10-point plan for a green industrial revolution is a good start, is a good first down payment, if I were to put it that way, as he said, but we need a lot more such acts going forward. We will have more details from the UK government in 2021 on its plans for individual sectors. And also, we can expect more such governments to release concrete action plans going forward in the years to come. As always, you can expect more such stories from the perspective of countries, global corporations, and entrepreneurs in the space on this podcast channel. So subscribe to the show and also do feel free to share your feedback. You can leave a review on iTunes, Apple Podcast, or send me an email directly. missionjunia@gmail.com is our ID. And the best place to know more about Dr. Reiner is by following him on Twitter, where he shares his perspectives regularly on energy policy. The handle and other details will be there in the show notes section of this episode and also on the website missionjunia.com. So, I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Until then, this is Girish Shivakumar, and as always, thank you for listening.